to try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. The way he was able to influence the masses, I very briefly put it out, but I want to elaborate on that a little more. The methodology that Imam al-Baqir presented to the Muslim Ummah that affected and influenced and was able to preserve and bring closer to the track and tracks of the Holy Prophet, what he laid down as the tracks for believers, the path, the true path, Sirat al-Mustaqim. This methodology was something that brought everyone closer to that path. The similarities are that we have come to a condition, brothers and sisters, whether it's in the wider Muslim community or particularly within the Shia community, we have come to a point where on a mass scale, the average believer, the Muslim that we have, especially I want to talk about the Muslims in the Western countries, the movement of Islam, the work of the ulama of Islam, the impact of it on Muslims living in Muslim lands, that's something that needs to be discussed at a different time. The conditions that we are facing here in the Western world particularly, which is what I'm more familiar with, in non-Muslim lands, there's different areas, and I'm not familiar with all of them. I'm more familiar with what's happening in the West. And what I see is very similar in to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do, because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is a, as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of U.S. foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yesha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be. Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against, and one abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023.
Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour, everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity, and wherever we go for refuge, hardship follow us. I'm happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India, who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Mohammed Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Mohammed's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Mohammed, who used to have a normal life, working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan Al-Attar, Mohammed's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the Civil Defense Services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubble.
I was at work when Mohammed called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubble. They rented ambulances. They were all
out on missions, and I had to wait for one. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubble. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling. Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
For the last time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Hemati and Mohsen Mehralizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Saeed Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
As part of Iran's action plan with the FATF, initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament, but the incumbent principalist-heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezai. Rezai says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president. While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To mark the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zazaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zazaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zazaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them, what about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zazaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zazaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country, we launch an attack to a bona fide citizen of an innocent citizen to his house, is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the Federal High Court order and release Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zainab. Tanjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a speech by Ayatollah Meshkini.
السلام جمله دارد ان من احب عباد الله عبدا از دوست‌ترین بندگان خدا از
امام علی peace be upon him has a sentence that I'm going to read to you. There are some servants of God whom he had helped to overcome their desires and selfness. What a beautiful phrase. This is a very important issue. These servants of God fear him and this will protect them. This way days will be passed and angels cannot record any bad deed from these servants because they fear God. So he helps them control their desires. My dear brothers and sisters, you should be very careful. You have been educated and this is very good, but you also need to learn something more. That thing you need to learn is piety and not to commit sins. Mama Sadiq says in this regard, even if the number of your good deeds is not considerable, it is okay. Just be careful not to increase the number of your sins first. This is the example of a tree which is watered and then grows well. It produces a few fruits, but they are with very high quality. Now, although the number of fruits is not so many, They are fresh and good, and this is admired by the gardener. Now, if the tree is full of fruits, but they have spots on them and with low quality, you pick them all but throw them away, and you just keep a few of them which seem intact. You put them in a plate and offer your guests. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Olama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Meshkini. Please visit our website, which is parsetoday.com, and by clicking on the tab Call of Islam on the top right corner of the page, you can listen to this program as well as the other programs of this radio station. And you can send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Zionist regime obliterated whole families in their homes during its 11-day attack on Gaza in May, some removed entirely from the population registry. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading Palestine, Families Obliterated, Lives Destroyed. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime obliterated whole families in their homes during its 11-day attack on Gaza in May, some removed entirely from the population registry. Parents and children, cousins and siblings, grandparents, aunts and uncles were killed together when the Zionist regime warplanes bombed residential buildings and private homes without warning the families inside. Killing multiple members of multiple families has become a the hallmark of Israeli wars on Gaza and has led to Palestinians there resurrecting some grisly traditions. People in Gaza have been reviving an old tradition in which some families exchange their kids so that, in case some get bombed, the others would live. Dear user, Muhammad Wadai wrote amidst the assault, "My family is spread out over three houses in three different locations as if they're trying to avert a massacre." Maha Muhammad Abu Hatab was visiting her brother Ala Muhammad Abu Hatab house for aid on May 15th when it was hit with three Israeli regime missiles, according to Al Mizan, a human rights group in Gaza. There was no warning. "My wife and kids went to share the aid blessings with her brother. They got dressed and went to her brother's house, innocent children." Muhammad Al Hadidi said of his wife Maha and their children, "The attack at 1:30 in the morning killed Maha and her children, as well as Allah's wife and children. Maha was 34. Her children, Suhaib al-Hadidi, was 12. Abd al-Rahman, 7, and their brother, Osma, was 5. Their 10-year-old brother, Yahya, was later also confirmed killed in the attack. Their cousins, Yusuf Abu Hatab, 10, and his siblings, 9-year-old Bilal, 7-year-old Maryam, and 5-year-old Yaman, were all killed in the strike. Their mother, Yasmin Muhammad Abu Hatab, 30, was also killed. Only Muhammad al-Hadidi's 5-month-old son, Omar, survived the Israeli regime's blast. In the early hours of May 13th, the Zionist regime warplanes dropped 20 missiles on a densely populated neighborhood in Beit Lahia. The blast killed 6 members of the al-Tanani family. Rafat Muhammad Ismail al-Tanani and his wife, Raya Fatih al-Tanani, were killed along with 4 of their children. Ismail 7, Amir 6, Adam 4, and their 2-year-old brother Ahmad were all killed in the attack, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. A 7th member of the family is still missing, DCIP reported. The same blast killed the wife and husband who owned the building where al-Tanani family was renting their home, Abd al-Rahim Muhammad al-Madun, 63, and his wife, Halima Ali Abu Sharah, 66. Stores, lawyers' offices, an education center, and 9 houses were completely destroyed in the Zionist regime's strikes. Nearby streets were also destroyed, along with water pipes and sewer systems, as well as telephone lines and electricity. An Israeli regime missile hit a 2-story residential building in Al-Manara neighborhood in Gaza City on the second day of the Zionist regime's onslaught, killing Iyad Fathi Sharir, 44, and his 40-year-old wife, Layali Taha Sharir. Their 15-year-old daughter, Lina Iyad Sharir, were also killed in the blast. After being hospitalized with severe burns after the strike, their 2-year-old daughter, Mina Yad Sharir, nearly survived the Zionist regime's airstrikes on May 11th. But the toddler died from her wounds a week later on May 18th, joining her parents and sister in death. On May 14th, the Israeli regime's warplanes dropped 2 missiles on agricultural land near a home in Beit Lahia, killing 3 children and their mother, Islam Muhammad al-Attar, 8, his 6-year-old sister, Amira Muhammad al-Attar, and their infant brother, Muhammad Zainuddin Muhammad al-Attar, were all killed in the attack. Their 26-year-old mother, Lamia, was also killed. The family was on the ground floor of their home, according to DCIP, and a concrete pillar fell on them. Their bodies were pulled from under the rubble hours after the attack. Lamia's father, a civil defense officer, told Amnesty International that he arrived at the scene with an ambulance and a rescue team after a relative called and told him of the attack. Hassan Al-Attar told Amnesty International, "I went to the three-story house where 20 people live, and I tried to find someone, but I couldn't. Then the rescue team came to help and eventually found my daughter, a mother of three, with her children, one of them a baby, under one of the pillars of the house. They were all dead. It seems the rest of the residents managed to escape the bombing and reach the hospital. I was shocked." In the early hours of May 12th, the Zionist regime warplanes fired two missiles at a five-story apartment building in Tal al-Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City, killing at least five Palestinians. Reem Saad Kamel Saad, 31, a pregnant mother, was killed alongside her five-year-old son, Zaid Muhammad al-Talbani. Her toddler, Maryam Muhammad al-Talbani's remains were only found the day a ceasefire was declared. The Israeli regime attack on Maryam's home was so huge and violent, and she was so tiny, that it took 9 full days to find her body under the rubble. Miranda Cleland of DCIP wrote on Twitter, "The children's father, Muhammad Odeh al-Talbani, was reportedly injured. Three others were killed in the same attack, while Abdul Karim Isi, 40, Muhammad Hassan al-Awaji, 34, and Hala Hussein al-Rafi, who was 13 years old. Iyad Abdul Fattah Salha was home with his wife and toddler one afternoon when an Israeli regime missile struck on May 19th, killing them all. Salha was disabled and used a wheelchair. His wife, Amani Yusuf Imawish, was 8 months pregnant. Their toddler daughter, Nagam Iyad Salha, was killed along with them. It remains unclear whether the missile was fired by an Israeli warplane or a weaponized aerial drone, according to DCIP.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's special episode of Muslim Lady, brought to you by IRIB English Radio. I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my friend, Zainab.
Fatimah al-Ma'asuma's character motivates us to reach our higher potentials, but especially as women.
Mm.
And to me, when I look at Sayyidina Fatima al-Ma'asuma, whether it was during her life or after her death, which was like her life was really short. She only lived 28 years, almost as old as I am now. And but I think she's a very good example of how Islam, in its truer form, in its essence, is an ideology that really and actually empowered women.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the greatest instances of that.
Exactly.
Whether it was throughout her life, the way her father interacted with her, the way her brother interacted with her, the way the men in her family, which were imams, and they were ma'asumin, they were infallible, they acknowledged her abilities, her knowledge, her piety, her great status with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They entrusted her with so many responsibilities. They believed in her abilities to such a high extent. And then after her death, we just went crazy for her. You know, we built this huge shrine, and so many of our scholars drew inspiration from her and were hoped to be buried in her threshold. And I think that's just so awesome.
It's an honor, actually, to live in the city where her shrine is.
Really, it is.
And a lot, as I said, a lot of the scholars, whenever they had any scientific problems, like they had a question and they couldn't solve it, they would come to her shrine. Mm. Or if they had, like, any material, like financial problems, emotional problems, they wanted wives, they wanted houses, they wanted more knowledge. One of the scholars says that, like, Sadr al-Muta'allihin Shirazi, Mullah Sadra, that you can, his house is in Kahak, like about 50, 60 kilometers away from Qom. He says that whenever I have I had a philosophical question, I would come to Bibi Masuma and I would actually ask her. And when you go back to the incidents, like, where this group comes from another city, at, you know, when she wasn't even nine at that time, then she writes, they have their questions, her father wasn't there, so she writes the answers to their questions, and, like, you find out the immense, the lofty, like, knowledge status that she had.
Exactly.
So no wonder that even now, we believe that as Shias, that whenever someone dies, like the shuhada, those who die in the path of God, they are still alive, and we can get a lot of blessings and bounties from them through the connection that we can have with God through them, you know? Something that I really want to know more about is that, like, the city that she went to when on her trip from Medina to the city of Marv all the way to Salve, really we don't know what happened, like, what caused her to become so ill and then to stop in Save, like, and then I really want to know how she interacted with the Muslims and with the non-Muslims on this journey, because it took, like, a really long time.
Exactly.
This is something that I've been wishing to know more about. And also about her personality. The 7 days that she was in Qom, what did she do?
I read an account where during that time she
was... 7 days you're talking
about? During those 7 days that she spent in Qom, she was very ill. And that perhaps one of the possibilities was that she was poisoned during the time that she was in Save after all her brothers were assassinated. They were ambushed, right, by the Abbasid mercenaries or army or whatever. And then she was poisoned, and because she found her death to be impending and she needed, like, a safe place for herself and the remaining women that were with her, she asked to be brought to Qom because she had heard from her forefathers that Qom is a sanctuary for the Shias of the Ahlul Bayt. And there's a hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam too, right, that there's a haram for Allah and there's a haram for Rasulullah, haram for Amir, and there's a haram for us, and it's Qom. She was brought here and then she fell ill. She fell ill and she was bedridden, and they were nursing her for a while until she finally passed away.
Yeah. And there's actually, like, there's a special house in Qom that is called Beit al-Nur, where they...
The house of light.
That's where they, like, they say that she's been worshipping throughout these seven days. But I'm sure that based on the fact that the Ash'aris, they invited her to come to their house, and they knew her high status, definitely respecting her family, like the Alawis, and Imam Ridha alayhi salam, you know, knowing his real position as the Imam of their time, definitely they would have visited her during this time and asked her questions.
I'm not very sure because I have a very faulty memory, but I think she did that as well for the women who came to nurse her and to take care of her and stuff like that. They would come and ask her a question, and she would explain tafasir and ahadith. She was a great narrator of ahadith.
one of the women, they carried out the hadith of Silsilat al-Thahab. And yeah, the hadith of Ghadir al-Khum is Sayyidah Fatima al-Masum alayhi salam. That was her mission through her journey from Medina till her assumed destination, which she never got to reach. And you know, the fact that she was able to answer those questions at such a young age, and again was given, entrusted with such a huge responsibility of carrying out the message and the rasala of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, and exploiting the schemes and the plot of the Abbasid caliphs. Because people are assuming that, oh, Imam al-Ridha is siding with Ma'mun, and now he wants to be Ma'mun's like heir apparent, and Imam al-Ridha has just gotten corrupted and this and that. And she needed to explain to people that no, that's not the deal. He's been held there against his will. Shows that in Islam, or in the Sunnah, the real tradition lifestyle of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, they see just as much potential in their daughters as they did in their sons. The fact that Imam al-Kadhim and Imam al-Ridha invested so much in Sayyidah Masuma, they put time and energy and effort to raise her, to train her, to teach her, to help her reach her potentials, just shows that, you know, to an extent, women probably can do everything a man can do. Well, sure, she didn't pick up a sword and fight people off, but in terms of intelligence, intellect, spiritual wayfaring, reaching those utmost highest levels of humanity, there's literally no difference between a man and a woman.
Actually, sometimes a woman can transcend a man in terms of spiritual status and her faith and everything, because I remember a beautiful hadith from Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Ta'ala Farajah Sharif, where he says, verily, in the daughter of the noble Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam, Fatima, there is a very good role model for all of us. And this is, we're not like talking about a random guy in the street. It's like a Masum guy, a Masum Imam. And or when we're talking about Asiya or the other ladies that are mentioned in the Quran, and the Quran specifically states that they are role models for men and women, and it's not like, you know, women, first of all, they can reach really high status. And some people like say, yeah, women are very good role models for other women. You know, somehow trying to like degrade them to some extent. But very explicitly, we have it in the Quran and in the narrations that women can be role models for men and women. And this is something that you don't have to like, being a role model, you don't necessarily have to be physically present or physically like very displaying yourself, or, you know, like your existence through your words, through your actions, you can do that. Just as Lady Khadija, salamullah alayha, that after her marriage, like prior to her marriage with the noble Prophet, she was a merchant that whom had like other representers, agents doing business on her behalf. Her very smart choice selection of these agents showed her how smart she was and how talented, and her high managerial skill, that you're able to have hands outside of your home, you know, send them to other continents, other cities, other countries, and to bring back to you a lot of profit.
Exactly.
What does this show? That you don't necessarily have to go out in the public and like shout to people that, hey, I'm here, I can do managing stuff. Like, this is something that the Western media has been really, really trying to like feed women's minds, that you have to be the super girl, where you have to like go there, wear tight clothes, flashy like makeup, have a good certain amount of, you know, like there's a standard for how you should, the way your body has to be, right? But the Islamic perspective is something quite different with how, you know, the version of the Islamic empowered woman is very different from the Western secular version of the unempowered, successful.
Exactly.
Right?
When it came down to it, there was still room, or there was no objection to a woman getting out there and getting things done.
Right, when it's necessary.
Yeah. Again, Sayyida Masuma sallallahu alayha is a great example for that. Or Sayyida Zainab sallallahu alayha, even Fatima al-Zahra sallallahu alayha,
yeah.
Even Khadija al-Kubra, all of them.
شفیع روز جزایی یا معصوم تو زینب امام رضایی یا معصوم ملیکه ارض و سمایی یا معصوم شفیع روز جزایی
At the end of the day, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going, you know?
And you know, I think there's only one, all these ladies, pure ladies, went out only in one. I mean, the reason for their going out and their presence in the public, if you analyze it, you come to one common cause,
mm-hmm.
which is
protecting wilaya.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Other than that, they had their tafsir classes, but for women.
Mm.
They had their benefactory charity organization, running them, through the city, and they had their own organization. I mean, they were active women, the mothers of the imams, the daughters of the imam, the sisters of the imams. But the thing is that only in that specific case of protecting the wilaya, they all went to the public,
exactly.
And they had a public presentation.
Mm. Which really, well, we're out of time, but it brings us to the question that how is the concept of protecting and defending wilaya manifesting in our time and age? At the end of the day, they all had their present ma'asum,
mm-hmm.
right? Who would live for a limited period of time, and if they did not do everything in their power to protect and defend him, he would be oppressed, usurped, and killed,
mm-hmm.
right? So they had a very limited time to come out and do whatever they had to do for wilaya. In any case, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you for being with us. Until another salam and greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.